First of all, thank you all so much for having me here with you in worship this morning. I got to meet a lot of people after the 9 o'clock service, and you're a very loving and welcoming group of people, so I'm grateful to be here. Second of all, I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to share my art with you all this Lenten season, and I hope you appreciate it. So when Pastor Chad told me about your social justice Lenten series and some of the different topics that you would all be addressing, I was pretty impressed. It reminded me of the strong biblical tradition of speaking out prophetically against social justice, which is also a very Wesleyan tradition. But it's not always easy to hear such messages. They are jarring and unsettling and often push us way out of our comfort zones. But they can also be transformational on so many different levels, ranging from the individual to the global level. And so as a church, you are willingly taking a leap of faith into the uncomfortable and transformational. And so for this, I applaud you all. So Pastor Chad invited me to speak about the subject of racial justice. And so to start off with, I'll tell you a bit about my racial background. So my name is Shona, which is a Scottish girl's name, as my mother was Scottish, and I was also born in Scotland. Shona is also the name of my father's tribe from Zimbabwe in Africa, and I was raised in Zimbabwe from age 7 through to 24. You might be wondering how it is that these two cultures from opposite sides of the globe came together to produce me. Well, my dad was born in what was then called Southern Rhodesia in the 1940s, a self-governed British colony that had a system of racial segregation, very similar to apartheid in South Africa. By the time my dad was a young adult, war had broken out. So my dad left Rhodesia and went to study nursing in Scotland, where he married my mother. So their mixed race marriage was just barely acceptable in the UK, but it was outright illegal in Rhodesia. However, when the war ended, our family emigrated to the newly independent Zimbabwe. Wars may end, but old beliefs, ideas, and prejudices very often die hard. So life was quite challenging for our mixed-race family. So I share all of this with you to highlight the merging of these two racial groups in my identity and how racial tension has always been a part of my experience, hence my passion for racial justice and healing. So to quickly round off my life story, I left Zimbabwe in the late 1990s as an adult when the political and economic situation became incredibly unstable, and I returned to the UK, and then I emigrated to the US in 2005. I have three children. My first was born in Zimbabwe, my second in the UK, and my third here in the US. So three kids, three continents. That's quite a feat. So the subject areas covered in my art was also inspired by them and also features them. Which brings me on to something else that I'd like to share, which is my journey with art. As a child, I always loved to draw and create, but I only started painting when I was 30 years old. What finally got me started in painting was the experience of deep, soul-crushing grief that started off with the death of my mother to cancer when I was 17 years old. And then the HIV/AIDS pandemic hit Zimbabwe pretty hard in the 1990s, and I lost many relatives to this disease. I also lost both sets of grandparents during this time, and then finally my father. I was able to be with my father in Zimbabwe for his last 2 weeks before he died. And as I was leaving to return home to the UK after the funeral, I realized that in addition to saying goodbye to him and grieving that loss, I was also saying goodbye to Zimbabwe as my home base. So back in the UK, wrestling with grief and homesickness, my mind was flooded with images of Zimbabwe, village scenes, landscapes, people, my deceased relatives. And so I started painting them. It's a well-known fact that art has healing qualities, and it was soothing medicine for my soul. A lot of that art is actually on display in a church in Ann Arbor. And the work of healing from grief also set me on to the path into ministry, although I had no idea at that time. But as I mentioned before, I emigrated to the United States in 2005, and I love the U.S. In 2017, I became a citizen, and I'm raising my kids here with the knowledge that their kids and all the generations to come will probably be American. I moved from a career in science and made a commitment to a life of ministry and service to this country because I know that this is God's will. And so when you love something or someone dearly, you're willing to invest your heart and soul into that relationship. That's what I'm doing with this country. You take delight in the good times and positive qualities, but you're also willing to do the hard work of making the relationship work by enduring the tough times and by confronting and speaking courageously about behavior that causes you pain in a loving and authentic way. And also during rough patches, holding on to hope for better times. So yes, I'm going through a rough patch now, as are many. And one of the purposes of having a faith or belief system is to help you make sense of your life, to help you through times of suffering, to help you stay grounded and connected in the midst of a storm, but also to help you navigate through the storm. So Jesus is at the center of our faith as Christians. And as Christians, we believe that Jesus was both human and divine. But I have to confess that in the past, I've tended to focus more on Jesus' divine nature, Jesus as the Son of God, my intercessor, to help me through. But recently, I've come to depend more on Jesus' human side, Jesus the man, as I call him, to help me make sense of my world and to provide wisdom and guidance. I believe that it is through the perspective of Jesus as a man living in a very specific context that we can truly understand his passion for social justice. So what helped make Jesus the man come alive for me was a book by a Muslim New Testament scholar, Reza Aslan. His book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, revealed an image of Jesus that I hadn't really been exposed to before, despite being raised in the church and going through 4 years of seminary education. I really liked his Jesus. His book also opened my eyes in new ways to the era that Jesus was living in and his social location in a way that was edgy and transformational, but that also sounded strangely familiar. Jesus was a Jew living under the reign of the powerful Roman Empire. He was a non-citizen, a religious and ethnic minority, lower class, and poor. During his ministry and at the time of his death, his father Joseph is no longer mentioned, and his mother Mary is alone at his crucifixion. His people, the Jews, were despised by the Roman authorities, oppressed and persecuted. The culture at the time was highly patriarchal, hierarchical, autocratic, and was set up to enrich and protect the privileged class and the powerful rulers. The poorer classes were heavily taxed and had no voice or representation. Dissension was not permitted, and those who dared were brutally executed. Jesus, though, was countercultural. He turned the rules of the reigning empire upside down and taught a different perspective, a different way of living and relating to each other. He called this the kingdom of God. He preached equality, radical acceptance, and unconditional love of neighbor. Jesus welcomed the outsiders, the outcasts, the marginalized and persecuted. And he was one himself. Jesus was rejected by his own people and then finally executed by the Roman authorities. It was the experience of deep grief after the death of my family that got me started in painting. And it was also the experience of grief that produced the art on display here. Like I said before, I really do love this country, hence the grief. our current context is that we are the most powerful nation on earth. We have a very wealthy upper class and a huge gap between the haves and have-nots. There has been a significant rise in the insider-outsider, us-versus-them mentality. The FBI reports sharp increases in reported hate crimes in the U.S. in the past few years. So these are very challenging times for many people. Grief and a strong sense of injustice, combined with my understanding of Jesus the man, inspired this series. And so last year for Lent, my home church, First United Methodist of Ann Arbor, invited artists in the congregation to produce art based on scripture passages that follow a theme, a Stations of the Cross theme. So each one of those pieces of art is my interpretation of the scripture, imagining Jesus here with us now in the U.S. I asked myself, where would he or even she be? What injustices might he or she be facing? What would grieve him or her? What would he or she look like? Your interpretations may be very different or valid. You'll notice that most of the characters displayed in the art here are dressed in blue and red. And so this was intentional to represent our flag, to put us here in this context. My hope is that the art will highlight some of the injustices in our country and help us all to grieve them, to remind us all of our values and who we really are, and to hopefully inspire us all into action in order to create a better place for all. And so I brought my children to this country that I love, and I'm raising them as Black in America. And as a family, we often have discussions about what that means. Toby, could I have the first slide? And so my son made a comment a few months ago about young Black men being the new cash crop. And what he meant by this was that it costs an average of $34,000 a year to take care of a prisoner here in the U.S. And in some states, it can even be as high as $60,000. Prison rates in the U.S. are the world's highest, at 720 people per 100,000. So there's some real good money to be earned by having people in prison, in the prison industrial complex, what some people call the beast. Why he said that young Black men are the new cash crop is because Black men make up 40% of the prison population, but only 6.5% of the U.S. population. Why the disproportionality? Well, our criminal justice system that some have described as two-tiered has historically dished out harsher penalties for certain populations, including people of color, with less severe penalties for the privileged. For instance, the war on drugs, the response to the crack cocaine epidemic of the 80s and 90s, resulted in huge, like 100-to-1, sentencing disparities for possession of crack cocaine, used mostly by African Americans, compared to possession of pure cocaine, used mostly by whites. Which is why my Detroit friends call the war on drugs the war on blacks. One friend pointed out a few weeks ago that now that we have an opioid crisis that affects mostly white, there's no talk of war or demonization and criminalization of addicts. Instead, it's a national disaster and public health emergency, and we have an opioid strategy to handle it. We even passed legislation to help addicts in affected communities called the Support for Patients and Communities Act of 2018. But the legacy of the war on drugs still lives on in Black communities. With felony convictions, lives were destroyed. Generational cycles of poverty and incarceration were initiated, and communities were devastated, which then led to increases in crime rates in poor Black communities and further criminalization of Black communities. Could I have the next slide? This represents my mother's grief So the school-to-prison pipeline also results in more young black men being disproportionately imprisoned, as zero-tolerance disciplinary policies and the presence of police in schools tends to affect young black students from impoverished backgrounds more than anyone else. But these are just kids. Kids desperately need of help. These are kids with learning disabilities or histories of poverty, abuse, or neglect, and who really need additional educational and counseling services. But instead, they are isolated, punished, labeled, and demonized, and many of them are then pushed out of the educational environment into the juvenile and criminal justice systems. You'd think that investing in education and empowering the next generation would be a priority for us, but instead the US government spending on state and local prisons has increased at triple the rate of funding for public education over the past 3 decades. And this is according to a 2016 report by the US Department of Education. There are some investments being made in education, though. A New York Times article from 2 weeks ago reported that school districts that predominantly serve students of color received $23 billion less in funding than mostly white school districts in the United States in 2016, despite serving the same number of students. On average, non-white districts received about $2,200 less per student than districts that were predominantly white. So black kids that go to underfunded, understaffed schools in impoverished communities when applying for college places and scholarships are competing with white students who have had the full experience, including music programs, sports, AP courses, college preparation support, the works. So guess who gets the college place and the full scholarship? So to stand a better chance, you really want to get into the good neighborhoods with the good schools, right? Well, the historic practice of redlining of neighborhoods, basically separating white and black areas and restricting certain services in black neighborhoods, combined with racial discrimination in mortgage lending, resulted in black neighborhoods still struggling economically decades after the practice ended. But it has also meant that blacks have not been able to invest in housing and accumulate equity in the housing market to hand down to succeeding generations as their white counterparts have. There are so many other issues I could get into here, like environmental racism, the fact that communities of color have higher exposure to air pollution, closer proximity to landfills, hazardous waste sites, and other industrial facilities, water contamination, lead poisoning, the Flint water crisis being one infamous example. We could also get into wage gaps, unfair hiring practices, workplace discrimination, hate crimes, police shootings. But fortunately, time does not permit, because this is really, really heavy stuff. It grieves me. What do we do? How can our faith guide us? So the scripture reading for this morning was the parable of the sheep and goats. And this is one that I've always loved. But if you've grown up in the church and with the Bible, 45 years later, it's hard not to hear the first sentence of that parable and think, yes, here we go again. Be a sheep. I remember. So in the same way that it took a Muslim scholar to open my eyes to Jesus the man, it was a Buddhist teacher who really helped me to see the parables of Jesus in a very different light. So the Buddhist teacher Adyashanti, in his audiobook Resurrecting Jesus, Embodying the Spirit of a Revolutionary Mystic, highlighted for me what a phenomenal wisdom teacher Jesus was. Adyashanti believes that Jesus' parables are saturated with wisdom and the potential for enlightenment. That's not easy to immediately discern and needs to be meditated on time and can serve to unravel greater truths about the world, very similar to Zen koans. So when Jesus is describing the purpose of the parables in Matthew 13, he says, "Let anyone with ears listen." This is why I speak to them in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. In them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but never perceiving. For this people's heart has become calloused. They hardly hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them. Understand with their heart and turn. I'd love to take you on a journey to explore the parable of the sheep and goats from a different perspective. It's unconventional, but remember that Jesus himself was unconventional and notorious for messing with people, for turning things upside down, for thinking outside the box. And one of the ways that he did this was through the use of his parables. Remember that Jesus rarely spelled it out for people. It was up to the hearer of the parable to go away and make sense of it for his or her life, to understand with their heart and turn. So when we hear a parable, most of us either consciously or subconsciously assign ourselves to a character in the parable. We might feel like the prodigal son, or hope that we are the seed that falls on fertile ground, and so on. We think we know who we're meant to be based on what we've been taught. But what does our heart say? So the parable of the sheep and goats opens with, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory." So immediately I think, wow, Jesus the man has returned. He then goes on to separate and welcome the sheep and thanks them for tending to him. And they respond by saying, "When did we see you?" At this point, I wonder how these sheep didn't see the image of Christ in their fellow man. When Jesus tells the sheep that they did it for the least of these, I see that the least of these appear to be a separate category. They seem to be with Jesus already because he says, "least of these," implying something nearby as opposed to "those," implying distance. And so it therefore seems like the least of these are neither sheep nor goats. I then begin to think of who the least of these would be here and now in our context, and whether they feel close to Jesus, or even like Jesus, the oppressed and persecuted man. So looking at this parable in a non-dualistic way, as a wisdom teaching for transformation, we might see that there are other characters we could identify with beyond the sheep and goats. There are the least of these in Jesus. Do we feel comfortable placing ourselves in the story as Jesus with the least of these? How could we be Jesus or the least of these here and now in this country of ours? Well, I think there are some things that we can all do to help us get there, and that I think would be transformational from a racial justice perspective. The first thing I'd say is to find new ways of seeing. So Jesus was a very keen observer of social dynamics. He had an eye for the outsider and would often offend social conventions by welcoming and affirming them. We can do the same. How? Well, the first thing I would say is, please don't be colorblind. See us. In social situations where people of color are present, observe how we are being treated by others. Do we look like we feel comfortable and welcome? If not, is there anything that you could do about that? It could be as simple as eye contact and a smile, a greeting, maybe even a conversation. Jesus was notorious for taking the time to stop, attend to, and then affirm and welcome people. Jesus also regularly forced people into introspection. Jesus himself, in his encounter with the Syrophoenician woman begging for healing for her daughter, reveals some possible ethnic prejudices of Jesus, the Jewish man. Do you know what he called her? He said, it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. So it sounds like he basically called her a dog. But then he went ahead and healed her daughter. I believe that we should check ourselves in a similar way. When we are around people of color, what goes on with our thoughts, our body language, the things we say, and how we act? Do we have stereotypes or unconscious biases that we can bring to light and work on? And no shame, no guilt, that's not necessary. We all have unconscious biases. We just need to be aware of them and work on them. Could I have the next slide, Toby? For instance, what storyline goes on in our mind with an image of a young black man in a hoodie and baggy jeans? Are we truly able to see people of color as brother or sister, or are they other? Are we able to discern when other racial groups are being unfairly demonized? Can we see Jesus when we look at them? Could I have the next slide? Do we feel comfortable speaking up as Jesus did so many times? Could we call people out for racist behavior? Are we willing to have difficult conversations over contentious issues, like Jesus did with the Pharisees and Sadducees, but with the insiders and elite of our culture? Do we have gifts, talents, and abilities that we could use to bring light to and heal situations of racial injustice? Anything from painting a few pieces of art to being a friend or an advocate of a person of color, maybe even protesting situations of injustice. When it comes to systems of oppression, social sin, remember the most important thing, your political power. Your vote is what counts the most. Research and understand the issues. I would highly recommend the movie 13th, available on Netflix, or maybe even reading Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. To learn more about mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex, don't just take it from me. Another thing, are we aware of our privilege? Once again, no shame, no guilt. Because Jesus used his popularity and authority to empower, heal, embrace, and affirm. How can we use our privilege in a way that helps minorities and people of color? How can we be good advocates? Next slide, please. And so one last thing. Let's break the silence. Let's break down walls. And let's raise people up. Give people of color a voice. Listen to our stories. Try to understand our perspective. Thank you, Pastor Chad, and all of you here for giving me the opportunity to share my story. How about we all take racism and injustice and oppression so personally as Christ lovers that we truly feel the pain and suffering of Jesus and the least of these. We're all in this together. Let's see Jesus in others, and let's also be Jesus in this country of ours. Thank you.